Hello everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome again to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Great to have you with us on this latest episode. Thanks everyone for your ongoing support. Keep the feedback coming. Keep reviewing, keep subscribing. Make sure you don't miss an episode. We drop one every Wednesday and this one is a special one. It's from the archives and it's with thanks to the team at the National Library of Australia, an interview with the late, great Bob Jane that as far as we're aware hasn't really been published anywhere. So we're bringing it to you first. Now, of course, Bob passed away not long before the Bathurst 1000 in 2018. This chat was recorded 10 years earlier, back in 2008, and it covers a whole pile of amazing territory. Bob talks about growing up in Brunswick, his days racing bicycles, and how he got into car racing. He talks about how he accidentally got into the tyre business, winning the Armstrong 500 with Harry Firth, despite Harry destroying the car in practice, true story, hosting the Australian Grand Prix at Calder and getting the top Formula One drivers of the day from the 80s, early to mid-80s out here to race, and of course a topic that is very close to our hearts, bringing NASCAR Super Speedway stock car racing to Australia with the Calder Park Thunderdome. Now, you won't hear my voice in this podcast. The voice you'll hear is Rob Willis, who sat down to record this interview with Bob in his office at Calder Park in Melbourne back in 2008. So here we go from the archives, Bob Jane on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco.
I was born at Carnegie, don't remember that, of course. Lived in Middle Park, Fraser Street Middle Park, from when I was born till I turned about 13. And I then moved to Brunswick with my mother, my brother and my sister, and lived there for another probably 20 years. We left my father, my mother, my brother and my sister and I. We left and went to Brunswick to work in my uncle helped us, my mum get a milk bar in City Road, Brunswick, and we lived, and it was a shop and a house above, and we lived there and worked there for probably about, I suppose, 10 more years. And Brunswick in those days was a pretty tough suburb.
I was just going to say, you'd have to be able to look after yourself a bit to live there in those days.
Well, unfortunately, that was the case because there's a lot of, I think as I recall, and I'm not proud of this, but Brunswick was the centre of the crime city of Australia. I reckon it was worse than Richmond, which seemed to be, people seemed to think was a bad suburb in that era. But Brunswick was worse than Richmond in terms of burglaries and drunks and robberies and fights and calamities, you know. So I had to grow up in that suburb. And I must admit, I thought I was a nice little guy until I moved to Brunswick, and I had to learn to fight and, you know, defend myself and my family, which I did reasonably well.
I pulled this out of a newspaper article. I'll just read it to you. Talking about Bob Jane. As a short, underweight kid in Brunswick in the 1930s, Bob Jane solved the local bullying problem by flattening the local lout, laid him out like a mackerel. Even the street gangs, which had been coming into his mother's milk bar and causing trouble, stayed away after that.
Yes, that's true.
That's Bob Jane?
Yes.
At that age?
Unfortunately, true. Unfortunately, necessarily true.
Yeah.
And it's something I didn't want to be involved in. It was foreign to my feelings, but I had to defend my family, my mum. It was a pretty tough place.
What about mechanical things? Like, I mean, you know, you'd always been pretty handy that way as well. You push bikes or did you?
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. I learned to fix my push bike, service it, race it. When I got a car, I mean, you learn things quickly. I was a mechanic in the early part of my life, working for Southern Motors, a company I eventually bought. But I was never a trained mechanic, but I learned to be a mechanic myself. I used to do work for Dick Beachy, Norm Beachy's father, repair his cars, do bearing jobs, piston jobs, fix gearboxes, which was pretty simple. Cars were pretty simple in those days, not with computers like today, you see. So I learned to be a mechanic by myself, and I was a bloody good mechanic. And at that time, I was an amateur bike rider, and I became a professional, and I started to win a lot of races. In fact, I won 7 wheel races at the Essendon Board Track in succession, and 7 heats and 7 finals. That's 14 races. Yeah. And I backed myself and my uncles who trained me. My trainer was a guy called Wally Don, and he was my trainer as well as my uncle. And we bet on we were confident I could win because I was pretty fit. I went wood cutting. I got myself pretty fit, and we went. And backed me, and this particular year I won so much money, I sent the book back, it's almost broke, because to win 7 heats and 7 finals in succession was theoretically impossible. And so you could get odds that I couldn't do it again, and I kept doing it. And I finally had the owner of the board track, his name was Campbell. It was a general motors dealer in Preston. He owned also the board track, a bit of a tycoon like I became in the later years. He rang me one day. He said, "Bob," he said, "I got a problem for the next season." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "Because you're taking so much money for the book," it's legally, by the way, mm-hmm. "and they're not very happy, and if you're around, they won't come." And I said, "Well," so in other words, he was banning me from the board track for no reason, no proper reason. So I said, "Well, bugger you anyway, because it's too hard to work here. I'm going to go motor racing," which is what I did.
Mm. Just a couple of things from that time in life. Some of us are good at one thing, but not other thing. Here we've got a bloke who's establishing his business with all this leather work and also being very, very competitive in a sport, the two things. Now, what I'm trying to get at, do these things complement each other, Bob? In other words, what you learn as your acumen as a business person, does that sort of reflect on your sporting ability and the other way around?
Well, there is an intelligent question, of course, because one of the things that, with hindsight, when I look back from...
And that's what we're talking about here.
When I look back from today, there's a lot of books... potential books they want to do on me for the last 5 years or more. And everyone wants to know my mentality, how I think about business, because I have been, I think, reasonably successful in business, but I do it differently. There's an element people want to know what role, as you're saying, if I repeat what you're saying in different words, a lot of people want to know what relation did motor racing have on my business, and what relation, what did my mentality and my business have on my motor racing, and why did I do things a certain way, which is why was I so aggressive in my advertising or my aggression or my apparent aggression in a race car, which was really aggression to win, and that aggression was there on the bikes, it was there in the cars. And one of the things that I raced in Aintree in England in the British Grand Prix in 1962. I got pole in the Jaguar, that model there. I raced for Jaguar themselves, Jaguar factory. And I got pole. That means I got, was the fastest car. During the race, I wouldn't let people slipstream me. They didn't comprehend that. But in the box, that's part of the winning, sitting on a guy. Anybody who understands that, you know. But in cars, it hadn't been thought about. And they said, I'll tell you the words. It was rather, I was seen as chunky Australian that got pole in the Jaguar, which really shocked the racing fraternity, right? I was with John Cooper at the time, and Sir Jack Brabham and Bruce McLaren. And having got pole, and they sort of came from everywhere to look at how this was possible, because I didn't have a really good car. I had a works car, but I had to fix it myself. And I had a mechanic. It was a car owned by a person called John Coombs, a Jaguar dealer at Guildford in England, in London. And the mechanic was given to me. He said, well, do whatever Bob wants. So I set the car up like I did mine in Australia, with little other things like springs and shockers and diff ratios and things like that. And in a car that hadn't won before. And anyway, after the race, they said to me, you know, a sale chap, you know, we don't really drive that, like that here. And because I came from Brunswick and trained in Brunswick, I said, stiff shit, old chap. That's how I race. And, you know, and why, and the officials want to know why I made violent moves on the track when I'm leading. So they couldn't sit behind me. So they didn't understand. In those days, no one comprehended that in motor racing, though they do well today, I can assure you.
Okay, you bought yourself a first car. Let's go back. The first car you bought. Now, you're a pretty hard worker, and obviously you've saved up and you saw this. What, Chevy, was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that was just transport.
Right.
And that was a car that I could afford at the time. Next car I bought was, when I was bike racing, was a 36 Buick. Beautiful old car, which I'd love to have now. Next car I forget about cars now, I got to think back. I bought a 1955 Ford Custom Line, new, in 55. And that's one of the first cars I raced. I got a photograph of that. I raced that Norm Beachy Race 1-2. At Albert Park in 56, and I raced it at Phillip Island, and I raced it at Fisherman's Bend. I raced it at a couple of racetracks. Not really a good race car, but you race your bike, you race your car, you know, and that's philosophy. Then I bought the 300S Maserati up there, bought that in 57. Raced that in the 58 Grand Prix at Albert Park. Came, I think, sixth or seventh in a sports car, which was not too bad at the time. Frightened myself to death and a few other people, but I survived it. So I bought that car it was a Works Maserati. I bought it from Red Smith Radio. He scared the hell out of him. That scared the hell out of me too, but that's the first race car I bought. So I went from nothing to amazing car in one step.
How many years are we talking here?
Well, that's 57. 57,
yeah.
Racing bikes in 49.
Nine, yeah.
Buying a Ford Custom Line in 55 and go from that to a bloody Maserati 300S Works race car.
Not bad.
Was it not a bad step, was it?
No.
Didn't think about it at the time, but...
Was part of the development of your business working because of what your love was of motor racing? You thought, if I can make a quid out of this, I can do
it? No, look, I got to tell you that one of the other sayings I've got, if it's any value, yes, or any interest to you, I find that life was a series of minor accidents for me. What I mean by accidents is that I'd like to be able to say today that, oh, yes, I was brilliant, I thought about what I should do very carefully, and so then I'm brilliant. But in all honesty, I can say to you that I bought the 300S race cars because it was owned by a friend of mine. I would be at auction, he wanted to sell it because he didn't want it. And that's the last thing in the world I should have bought to start with. I should have stayed and worked up, but I really went from a 55 Custom Line to a Works Maserati in 2 years, and could have killed myself in it easily. But it was, so I can't, that happened in an evolutionary way rather than a planned thing. And see, I'm in the tire business to jump the story.
Yep.
That in 1962, I was a Jaguar dealer. And I was a Jaguar dealer because Mr. Bryson, the family who sold Jaguar in Australia, was a saw what I'd done. I went and bought a car. Well, let's go back a little bit. I said to Harry Firth, Harry was a good mate of mine. We raced in Bathurst together. So I said to Harry, what do you reckon, Harry? What should we race the, as you'll see there, the race together in those two cars in the middle. The first of all, in 61, we raced in the 220 SEB. Yes.
Okay.
And then in 62, we raced the Falcon Pursuit. Just pictures there. Then in 63, we won Bathurst together the first time. But during that period, I said to Harry, what do you reckon is the best car, Harry? And clearly, and obviously, and all Harry did was confirm what I sort of already knew, but he was my old mate and my confidant. He said, a Jaguar. So I went down to Bryce and bought that Jaguar. I bought it in its HJN710, and I won the 62 and 63 Australian Touring Championship, right in the middle of all this racing, you see. So it's not as if it was one thing we did. So there was a decision I made to buy a car. It cost the price of a house in those days. You got to remember that money, I bought my mum a house about this time, cost me £3,000 for a house in Spring Hall Road, Pascoe Vale. That car was £2,600. A bit of money, but I didn't have a lot of money, but I had enough money to go and buy the car. If you know what I'm trying to explain.
Yeah.
And it won me two championships. It made me world famous because that car, I went to pick up a car in England in 62, saying you won the championship, they said to me, would you like to, Lofty England, who's the works manager of Jaguar, run at Le Mans, run the racing program, made the D-type Jaguar, the C-type Jaguar, the E-type Jaguar. I went and picked up a new Jaguar car at the factory. Would you like a race? Drive. So I drove there, and then they gave me the following year a lightweight E-type Jaguar works car. They gave it to me. So I was in dreamland, and I didn't know it at the time, but when I look back, you know, I didn't appreciate it. Well, I did appreciate it, but I didn't see the significance of it as I do now. To have a works lightweight E-Jaguar, I was the only made 20 in the world. They gave me one because I drove so well. So what I'm trying to say, by buying that car, then the Bryson family adopted me and offered me the Jaguar dealership. And so through the Jaguar dealership, I had a problem with tyres on the Mark 10, and I'm sitting there, and I sold cars to a lot of people, of course. I was very successful as a new Jaguar, and the Bryson family promoted it. You know, they were happy to give me anything I wanted. I got all the E-types I wanted. I got all the Mark 10s I wanted, all the Mark 2s I wanted. So it was really a dream come true, which, again, I have to look back to appreciate that. And there was a problem with the tyres on the Mark 10 Jaguar, so, which is the story of my life in a way. So I'm sitting there. I sold Jaguars to Watkins, the butcher. And he lives in Toorak, and he's a good, he wasn't a friend, but he because of the race driver, he bought his cars from me, and he rang me, not abused me, he was saying, Bob, why can't you fix my car, my tyres? I said, I'm sorry. I replaced the tyres, but the tyres are no better. So the accident happened again. I get a letter from my associate in the city, Laurie O'Neill. We're selling Peterbilt trucks at the time. And he got an offer of truck tyres, and he just ran it to his PA, sent this down to Bob, which it came. I'm looking at it the same day as Larry Watkins is grumbling at me, why can't I fix his car? I'm such a famous race driver, and he bought his cars from me, he's my friend. I said, I'm sorry, because, as I explained, the only replacement size is that tyre is the same thing, and it's no better. So when I got the letter from Laurie, it said, full the tyres. So realised what I'm doing, I sent them a Talix. And I said, listen, Mr. You offered a Mr. O'Neill to pull the truck tires, but do you make passenger tires? And they wrote back and said, "Not yes, Mr. Jones, we make passenger tires. We make all the tires as OE for Mercedes-Benz. So give me the sizes." And they had a size. Was a it was a size that would replace the Jaguar tires, whether it was the first radials, SP3s they were. So I said, all right, send me some. So I got them out, and that fixed the problem. And you know, all my friends who had Cadillacs and Jaguars and Bentleys and the same type fitted them, so I started supplying the tires. My spare parts department got so big with tires, I said to get these bloody things out of my dealership. So I set up a separate place to sell the tires because it's a pain in the ass in my dealership.
Yeah.
I set up in Brunswick, I got a picture of it actually, and of the store beside my Jaguar dealership in Brunswick. So I had one in Saudi, I had one in Brunswick, selling Jaguar in both places. And I started at late 1962 with bringing full the tires into Australia. I really didn't get fully going until about 1965, the time it takes to. I ended up with five brands of tires and 9% of the market by 1970, by 71, 11% of the Australian tire market, which was amazing. But again, I can't say to anybody, listen, I'm so bloody smart, I planned all this. That was one something that happened. And I use the word accidentally. It's not an appropriate word, but it's a good word to explain that I can't claim my brilliant thinking did it, but the market wanted those tyres. I hit the spot at the right time.
Let's go back to the early days. Now, we're talking the first one here in the 220 SEB. What's the B? I know the SE is a fuel injection.
SE is a model. E is for injection. B model. I don't know. SE. Yeah.
Now, here we have a standard motor vehicle that you've taken to Phillip Island at this stage of the game. Mm. Was it the fact that you and Firth could sort of get together and drive the thing, or
no? Very unusual. I drove a Falcon in 1960 with Lou Molina.
Yeah,
and Lou rolled it, and we came about six or something. In the first year, the two boys from Tasmania raced a 220 SUV, and they rolled it, so it got nowhere. But it showed potentiality of being fast. So Harry and I sat down, talked about it for 61, and I went down to Three Point Motorsport, a demo, that car, and we couldn't do much too because they were production cars. So you tune it, change the plugs, shockers. We did some work with Olympic tyres to develop tyres for it, and we used those tyres. And funny enough, I was the lead driver because, you know, Harry was smart. I was young and crazy and fast. So I was fairly fast very fast in those days. I could always get a pole. And Harry, I started and we got a puncture in the first lap. And the puncture required you to change the spare with the tools in the car in that year, 61. So I had to get out on the racetrack or off the racetrack. Jack it up with a jack that was in the boot, the wheel braces in the boot, and chains to put the spare on. And I had to drive my ass out all day, because I lost more than a lap. And I drove all day like a lunatic. Well, not like a lunatic, as fast as I could, without let up, just no brakes. Harry did the same. Like, Harry had to share the driving with me. And we won it, which was a minor bloody miracle, having two laps out of the race behind. It took us all day to pick it up. So we won the race, and that was great.
Next year was the Falcon. Now they had a notorious front end in them, and didn't they? They were a shocker of a thing. Those.
Harry used to drive, having won the Phillip Island race with a Mercedes. Harry, who had been working with the Ford Motor Company on rally, they obviously give so. Well, I had a couple of Pursuit Falcons. I got all the pictures of them in my files there. If you ever want to go through them. And so again, Phillip Island's a pretty fast track, and I had the skill and would help, and Harry was a great guy. Harry would help me with restraining me and putting a bit of put a bit of maturity into my driving and my what I did. But he recognised I was quick, so with that control over me, and without doing silly things or anything like that, Harry rolled the Falcon on the Saturday night before the race in '62.
He didn't mention that.
Destroyed it. He said, "Bobby," said, "we were on Michelin tyres that year, and it was coming up over the hill, and the thing jumped on its head, and we had a second car, and we transferred everything overnight the Saturday night. We transferred it to the new car or the other car, and we won again with that. And now we were challenged by the police club for changing the car, and they wanted to arrest us and put us in jail because they couldn't understand or comprehend, or I don't know what the proper word is, but they thought they had an angle that replacing the body, which is a part, was not the same car, but of course it's like the axe for turning your heads and turning your handles. Yeah. But they lost that. But Harry, maybe we get that right with Harry. He jumped off the ground onto his roof in practice on about 5 o'clock on the Saturday of practice.
Oh, shit.
I'll tell Harry, you're pushing these people, Harry.
Now, the year after that, if my memory correct is right, you went back to the four cylinders with the...
We got the Cortina, 14 GT.
What do you think of those?
Wonderful car. Amazing car. Absolutely amazing because... As I recall, in '63, the year we won at Bathurst, Harry and I together again for the third time, it was a four-cylinder car. It had 93 horsepower. We dynoed it. We did 129 miles per hour. We weren't the fastest, but Harry is a funny bugger. You know, he's a Secret Service agent. I tease him and still do that he would follow the numbers of his feeler gauge, and I could see the mad tweak that he would do to cars, because in those days, production cars, you could change the, and all you could do is increase the tapper clearance and the front end alignment and the tire pressures. There's very little you could do to a car to change it, but Secret Service agent Harry Firth would do those kind of things, but he could see better than me, I must say. I wasn't that confident. I didn't lack confidence, but I wasn't as sure as he was the car could win, because we had Studebaker Larks, which we also tested, were quite a bit faster. But of course, the hare and the bloody turtle story is very appropriate, because after about 5 or 10 laps, they got their brakes too hot, they're too heavy, all the things we know about racing cars. This little car went the whole race. We didn't lift the bike, we didn't touch the oil, didn't check the water, did nothing. Just drove like a mad dog all day, and it won. And and of course, Harry had prepared the engine, and all he ever did was look at the parts bin at the Ford Motor Company and down at Geelong and take parts that were, let's say, were cuts to the max of strength for front-end parts for the holes in the intakes for the, and we had 93 horsepower, and that engine was like gold because the most anyone else had was 91 horsepower from that engine. And that when we won the race, that car became a rally car because it had this demon engine that had 93 horsepower, brake horsepower, which in those days was very, very powerful little car.
Yeah.
And disc brakes on the front. And then the second year, which with I won without Harry now, because Harry and I had different sponsors, I ran with George Reynolds, was the long distance one, where they put a bigger fuel tank in the back. So it's called, first one was a Cortina GT, second one was a Cortina GT 500.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
Yeah. And that progressed, and you were doing other forms of motorsport at all at this particular
point?
Well,
I had the Jaguar racing at the same time. I had, we were selecting cars like pedigree horses in our own way that we thought could win for various reasons. Harry was very wise. They called him the Fox, but he wasn't. It was quite a valid thing, you know.
Yeah. Any particular cars out of that era that sort of, you know, I'll take that one home, it was one of your favourites?
Well, the Jaguar was, of course. Yeah. I had a private car, it was a Jaguar. My brother had a Jaguar Mark II and I had the race car. But, you know, cars are like shirts, you change them.
The tool of the trade, I suppose.
That's right. They were not emotional things in those days, even though I've got that Jaguar.
Yeah.
And I've got that Camaro up there.
Yeah, and the ZL.
Yeah, I've got that.
Yeah. Now, you've got a few of these still wandering around the place. Yes, you've got one of the Cortinas, haven't you?
No, the museum's got a clone of it.
Oh, right, okay.
I've got the Camaro, the Jaguar, the McLaren. I've got a few cars.
Yeah. So, getting aside from touring car racing, your other interests as well in the sport, Bob?
Well, we won the... Well, first of all, I bought the Brabham from Sir Jack Brabham in 1965, and we won the, with Spinsbun driving, won the Gold Star 55 or 56, 57, two years. I prepared that car for what our race team did. I drove it I tested it here because Spencer lives in Sydney, so I prepared the car here in Melbourne, not here, the track, test it here and take it up from it. So I've done a lot of laps in that car myself. The McLaren car, John Harvey won two national sports car championships in. I also won a lot of races and probably also. So different cars, you know.
Yeah.
Different shirts in different areas, you know.
Yeah. What created you interested in NASCAR? Was that something that went back a while too?
Well, NASCAR is another story. I went to America in 1964 as a guest of the Ford Motor Company, having won with the Falcon, having won the Cortinas. And in 63, 64, Falcon in 61. As a guest of Ford Motor Company, went down to Charlotte, North Carolina to watch the NASCAR race down there. And I met the Holman family who prepared the NASCAR races cars for the Ford Motor Company and for their drivers in that era. I went to the Holman family home, did water skiing, and got to know a lot of people there. And I thought, well, what a great sport, so bad. So that was 64. In 1980, I got the Grand Prix for Australia, well, for 5 years here. And during the years from 80 to 84, and the following year went to Iran, so I did a deal for it to go as an international event to Adelaide. I started talking, and I went down to see NASCAR in 82. Remember, so there's 8 years elapsed since I'd been to Charlotte. I met Bill France Sr., the guy who founded NASCAR. I met the son of Bill France, who now, just in that era, 1982, he'd become the CEO, but still under his father's leadership. I met Bill France's daughter. I met the family. And we agreed in 82, in principle, that I could run NASCAR in Australia. And I had to build a... It hadn't been a track built in 20 years, that stage. And I said, I'll build a track. Without me realising that I was... Most people thought I was full of bullshit. I did want to do it. So I bought the land. I got the permit in 84. Had it finished by 88. That's it over there.
Yep.
Now it's being re-engineered again, because it went for 11 years. Honda built one and spent $2.2 billion. $1 billion in Japan to build one. They ran it for 3 years. They got lots of money. I built mine myself. I built that myself, more or less. When I say I build, I get contracts to build a bill, put in millions of tons of soil, everything like that. And anyway, we opened the track in 1988 and ran it for 11 years. It was pretty good. But it was really before its time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because basically in 2000 we had problems with insurance and troubles with people and the economy and things like that, airstrikes, and a lot of things happened. Anyway, I stopped running racing in 01. So that was, what, seven years ago. But I've now got a contract with them again to run it again. So we're now rebuilding the whole place.
Yeah. And that just brings us back to, you mentioned bringing the Grand Prix to Australia. Can you tell us, just run us through
what the sequence was with that?
What happened? The Grand Prix, Australia... He's got a rich history of motorsport. It's in other words, we run Australia. When I say we, Australia as a nation, I talk as an Australian. Australia has run one way or another the second oldest Grand Prix in the world, French being the ahead of us. So we're second only to France, who's the originator of the Grand Prix. The Grand Prix was being run, has always been run in Australia, as a national event. In other words, we wouldn't have international participation, but the Australian Grand Prix was sanctioned by and run by people delegated by the Confederation of Australian Motorsport in that era. And in 1979, because touring car race became so popular that it had been, and I run the Formula One car in 66, 67, as I said, but then I got out of it. And because my love was touring cars, because, well, I didn't relate, I should have related it, but I didn't relate it to the tire business, but to me, that's what I'd done. And all I wanted to do, wasn't much use in open wheel cars because I didn't relate to them, you know. Again, one of those decisions that by accident I made the right decision, but not for the right reasons, you know. So by 79, the Grand Prix in Australia had become nothing. It was a race at 11 a.m. on Sunday morning at Sandown. And no one arrived till lunchtime to watch the touring cars. So it was really nothing. And the manager of CAMS, who I currently, well, I won't say hate, but
I know there's been a bit of a ruction there.
Well, they're in serious trouble right as we speak, but this, they said to John Sawyer, who's my manager here, would be running the Grand Prix because it's such a disaster. So John came to me and I said, oh, yeah, okay, we'll get behind it and do what we can. And as I wrote to Ron Walker the other day, I said, God was good to us because Alan Jones won the World Championship in 1980 and he's a personal friend of mine. So I ring him and said, why don't you bring your Williams out, Alan? So he did. And we brought, and I had a bunch of, and I had another friend, Daniel Girard, who's a French national, because I was lucky, because I was one of my friends, I bought tires from Holland, France, and Germany, and Taiwan, or China. So I already was working in France with Kleber, and I got to know people who in turn could help me in 1980 with the Grand Prix. Daniel Girard was a journalist and a famous chef. He knew all the Formula One drivers, so they came for peanuts because we knew them. They come for a nice weekend of racing in Australia. We looked after them. They loved it. So as a result of that, I could see, going back to the NASCAR thing, I could see that the Jubilee Committee in South Australia wanted the Grand Prix of Adelaide, and I spent 3 years taking the drivers who would come to Adelaide after the Grand Prix here in Melbourne at Calder to be interviewed by the media and by everybody, because they were quite famous people in those days. I mean, we got Nicky Lauder and those sort of people, top Formula One drivers on planet Earth, would go to Adelaide with me, and we go to a hotel reception and the media would be there and they'd all say, I'll give you the letter I wrote to Ron confidentially. And they said, oh, well, Grand Prix can never come here. I said, why? So I own a racetrack here. I've got 20 stores here. Why wouldn't you come to Adelaide? What's wrong with Adelaide? Oh, well, it's only got 1 million people, so... So that mean the Grand Prix can't come out. You know, that's how I work with them. Eventually, after doing that for 3 years, I got the ear of the Premier, and Bernie Eccles and I were working together on it because you read the letter. I won't waste my words. Nothing in the letter is confidential except I sent it to Ron Walker for a different reason. To explain the economic impact that came out of I went to the sports club of Monaco in 1982 and saw how it worked, how the Principality of Monaco got extra economic impact. You can read it. So by the time in that 80 to 84 was the last event I ran in October 84, I've already got the land. On October 84, I'm starting to build the NASCAR track. At the last day, I stood up on that grandstand there, watched the scraper down, getting it ready. I'd already been to see NASCAR. They agreed that by when I could build the track, I got NASCAR, and that's coming 88. So it's a pretty busy boy, you know.
There you go. What a special chat from the archives with Bob Jane. A big thank you to the team at the National Library of Australia for providing us with that audio. Really fantastic to listen to a legend of the sport. Heard some of those stories before, some of those ones I haven't heard. It is great to hear a legend of the sport on our podcast over the journey. We've got some more from the archives episodes that we'll wheel out over the course of the upcoming months. Keep your ears peeled. Keep your eyes peeled too on our website, bookshop.vhsleuth.com.au. We've got a bunch of new release books, some new stuff coming. Father's Day's on the horizon, Christmas not far away. Jump on there and grab yourself some copies. We've got some great books. The Perkins Engineering Car History book's a few months away. The Adelaide 500 history book's out now. Neil Crompton's book is not too far away. It's going to be a big Christmas and a big Father's Day for those who love their motorsport books. Jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Join our newsletter too through our regular V8 Sleuth website. And of course, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Keep the messages, keep the feedback coming. We love hearing from you about our podcast, who you'd like to hear on upcoming episodes, any questions that you might have for our Q&A episodes. We've got a lot in store for the second half of 2021. Anyway, that's us done. Hope you've enjoyed this episode. I'll chat to you again next time on another episode of the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco.